I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
From Mermaid Palace and Radiotopia, welcome to The Heart. I'm Caitlin Prest. This is episode 3 of Divesting from People Pleasing. In the last episode, NK realizes that she's looking for release, a way to externalize shame. In this episode, she finds a way how. Episode 3, Memory.
When your mother is still a baby inside her own mother, your DNA already exists. To put it simply, we receive aspects of our grandmother's mothering through our own mother. The traumas our grandmother endured, her pains and sorrows, her difficulties in her childhood, the losses of those she loved who died early, these filter to some degree into the mothering she gave to our mother. If we look back another generation, the same would likely be true about the mothering our grandmother received. These patterns appear to be hardwired into the brain and begin to be formed before we're even born. How our mother bonds with us in the womb is instrumental in the development of our neural circuitry. A life completely devoid of trauma, as we're learning, is highly unlikely. Traumas do not sleep, even with death, but rather continue to look for the fertile ground of resolution in the children of the following generations.
It didn't start with you. How inherited family trauma shapes who we are and how to end the cycle, by Mark Wallen. We started going on these Black History vacations. Me, my mom, my dad, and my sister. We went to Washington, D.C., where my mom is from, because we wanted to visit the new Smithsonian, the African American History Museum. At the museum, you work your way up from the basement, from the exhibits on the invention of whiteness and the Middle Passage, through emancipation, reconstruction, and the civil rights movement. In that section, the section that covered the civil rights activism of the 50s and 60s, I stood looking for a really long time at this photo of Ruby Bridges. When she was 6 years old, she desegregated an elementary school in New Orleans in the same year that my mom was 6 years old. When Ruby arrived at the school with her mom, they were escorted past an angry mob of white parents who later refused to send their kids to school with the Black girl. I've known the image of Ruby Bridges since I was a kid because my parents had a framed print of the problem we all live with, a Norman Rockwell painting depicting a little Black girl in a white dress. She's flanked by four white men in suits, U.S. Marshals. And the small girl's head barely reaches their elbows. A racial slur is scrawled across the wall behind them. It looks as if someone has thrown a tomato at them. The fruit slides down the wall behind her, leaving a red trail in its wake. When I was a kid, I thought the girl in the Norman Rockwell painting looked like me. Her hair is in pigtails and stiff braids that stick out straight behind her head, just like mine did. In the photo that inspired the painting, the photo that is in the Smithsonian, Ruby is ascending the steps of the school with the U.S. Marshals. In the museum, it's the text beneath the photo that captures my attention. Beneath her photo, the text quotes one of the U.S. Marshals, who said she showed a lot of courage. She never cried. I can't help but think about the 6-year-old girl.
She never cried.
The angry mob, the men in suits. Would she have been any less heroic if she had cried? It's been 3 years since divesting from people pleasing and 3 months since I started therapy, and I'm in another workshop.
Kind of keep us regulated or let us know.
In class, we study the brain, the prefrontal cortex.
Hey, heartbeat, you can slow down because you're in a really safe environment.
The part that handles emotional regulation and safety and the fight or flight response.
Or, you know, stomach, you can relax and it's okay to eat right now.
We also learn that there's a third response, to go numb.
Because it's the body's way of saying,
when your body thinks, we can't make it out of this alive.
And so I'm going to keep you safe by making it so that you can't feel anything.
Soon I realize I need a witness to my shame.
I just want to remember this, that
I feel compelled to document and share this process.
Got out of therapy and told my therapist that,
it's like, to me it just means it's like, that feeling is like all the things I don't say, like all the ways I'm not
expressions
public.
Of sexuality in public.
I want to like disappear. Really like I want like no one to ever see me again. I don't want to have to be seen.
People pleasing. I spent all day.
All of the things that are immersed. Unexpectedly coming up for me
by other people,
which I start to think of as my decolonizing.
Like I wish I didn't feel so like alone in this process.
My name is Meenakshi, and I facilitate nonviolent communication workshops, specifically with a decolonial lens. So today's workshop is going to be looking at shame and rage.
Before that day's somatic exercise, we discussed our relationship to shame and rage. And I share that I'm not easily provoked to anger, other than the righteous rage I direct towards bigots, rapists, and unjust power structures.
I think a lot of people are ashamed of feeling angry, but like, who are the bodies that I think could benefit from being able to have access to rage in a healthy, safe space?
Before that day's workshop, some of us had been asked to participate in the somatic exercise, which asked us to channel and release our rage, which asked us to push against Meenakshi, our facilitator, for 3 minutes. It was both a vocal and physical exercise, and I was reluctant to do it.
We're outside, and the moon is probably the brightest light. And there is also this quality of energy that is just running around and through the group to where the group feels really connected. One of the things that feels like a thread that connects us is that we're all people of color, almost all people of color.
One by one, the people Meenakshi had chosen before went up to do the exercise.
You put your hands on me. And we would move together and you would just push as hard as you could.
If I felt anything in my body in the workshop, it was the familiar feeling in my throat when I'm holding something that I need to express.
And at the same time, you would be making vocalizations. And they could be any kind of sounds, like grunts, yells, whatever you want, but no words.
I mostly felt it while watching others release their rage.
And we're also moving out of the story or the narrative of what the rage might be, right? Especially because a lot of the work is that underneath rage is a lot of grief.
Each time someone finished their turn, Meenakshi would look at me. But I needed several invitations to participate, and then permission to use their body. And finally, reassurance that they could actually withstand my release.
So you're going to put your hands on me right here.
I placed both hands on Minachi's body beneath their shoulders.
So when you're pushing on me, I need you to push consistently.
And I started to push a little.
I can really feel the hesitation and resistance.
But then I whispered to Meenakshi, I don't think that I can push you. I don't think that I can do it. I can't push you. I'm sorry.
I know that this is not an activity that is beyond what her capacity can hold. And there is an underlying need for me to be able to take us there, to be able to get us there. And I know that I can't do it by myself. I know that NK can't do it. Like, it can't be just the two of us. And so I'm hoping that pulling in these other three people will help us get us to where we need to be.
In response, Meenakshi said to the rest of the group, okay.
Okay, so I'm going to have three people come stand behind NK. And I just want you to be with her and just make sounds as she goes. Just make whatever sounds feel appropriate as we're working.
So then I push against Minachi's body.
So now we're moving.
Slowly at first and then faster.
There's a stronger energy coming from her end.
As she's doing it, like her head moves up and down. She's kind of, and just breathing.
And I can also feel the energy of the three people behind her.
You would pause in between, but even though you were still resisting and just kind of take deep breaths and like to put, start
and
pushing again.
I'm sensing, hoping, imagining that that energy is flowing into her body.
But I heard the people behind me making different noises. I wasn't sure how many people there were. They were sort of like making those noises like, of release.
Like it was a lot of release of like air deep. And like long, with every push breath. Came like a sound from your throat, guttural, like grunts. Also, like I was also crying because I was like feeling all of this emotion like radiating. There was like one final good push and then it stopped, it ended. It was so emotional.
It feels like NK falls into my arms. It's like the first time that we've had, that I feel like she has let me hold her in this space or in this way.
It was very like palpable that there was stuff inside that needed to come out. So
a total of six people did the exercise. I was the last one. Afterwards, we went back inside and we talked about it. And there was no explicit or linear connection made between the conversation about shame that we'd had earlier that day and this final rage exercise.
Well, just because in the previous sessions, the folks that had gotten picked for this activity had expressed that they had a hard time talking about how they felt or communicating their feelings or even like not being able to cry.
I don't know. Yeah, just the comfort level you had with like your feelings, feeling your feelings. I knew that there was just like stuff in there that wanted to come out.
That someone said, Hermina said the most revelatory thing.
It was just kind of like you were exhausted. It just sounded like you were tired of holding this stuff.
And I was just so shocked that she said she could feel that, because in that moment when she said it, I hadn't been thinking about it during the pushing, but in the moment when she said it, I felt like everything drained out of my body. Like, yeah, I am so tired. I'm so tired of having to hold this. It's like having to hold the posture, like the constant sort of the rigidity of like constantly policing myself.
And I remember thinking about that thing, like, you know, all the women in me are tired. And I think that it came back to that when we all kind of like shared back. I guess it confirmed what I was thinking when you talked about, like, you know, issues with the ways in which your mother would express herself or lack of expression. But whether or not you express it doesn't mean you don't feel it, right? So I felt that maybe you carry that without even meaning to. We all carry things that we don't mean to carry because we inherit pain and trauma and love and all these things that the women before us have carried.
For any like any work that we're trying to do with collective experience, with witness, and with knowing your body, to be able to discern what is rage and what is grief. Because if we confuse the two, we don't actually attend to what needs to be attended to. I guess grief just feels like big fucking open water. And then rage feels really clear. It feels very direct. It feels like a boundary. It also feels like, you know, when it is acknowledged, when it is really heard, listened to, attended to, it can dissipate immediately. It doesn't have a need to hold on and stay in the body.
On a neurophysiological level, each time we practice having the beneficial experience, we're pulling engagement away from our brain's trauma response center and bringing engagement to other areas of our brain,
specifically to our prefrontal cortex, where we can integrate the new experience and neuroplastic change can occur. Minacci tells us that trauma isn't always a big event, like rape or abuse or other kinds of physical violence.
Like, even the framework that we used, right, is really ableist, colonial sort of framework, the idea that I'm supposed to be able to live by myself.
There's also trauma anytime we don't experience belonging or feeling safe in a group.
But the idea that I'm supposed to be able to survive in a context where I'm not loved and celebrated.
In fight or flight, your inner ear shifts to hear the lower frequencies of predators, which means that today, in a contemporary setting, we may not hear the higher tones and the voices of the people we're speaking to, the tones that would reassure us that we're safe and wanted and not actually in danger of attack. The terrible asshole voice in my head once kept me safe, but now it's preventing me from fully living my life, from experiencing connection with the people I most want to connect to. My public persona, the person I am in the world, has been shaped by what was essentially a coping mechanism.
So fucking stupid. Everyone hates you. You're so fucking stupid.
In Minacci's workshop, we learn to confront our demons.
You're a fucking asshole. You're a fucking bitch. You're a douchebag.
To write down what they say.
Shut the fuck up. What are you doing? What do you think?
This is fine. And to thank them for their service.
Shut up. No one wants to fuck up. No one wants to fuck up.
It's fine.
And then to tell them that we don't need them anymore. That winter, I'm home for the holidays with my parents and my sister. My parents live near Nashville. And in the days after Christmas, we drive 4 hours south, through Memphis and across the state line, into Alabama, to visit a part of the South I've never been to. Birmingham, Selma, and Montgomery. It turns out to be the closest I have ever felt to a homeland. From Birmingham, we drive a few hours south to Selma. Where we walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where 600 voting rights activists began their march to Montgomery in honor and in protest of a black man killed during a voter registration drive. It was raining in Montgomery when the marchers arrived from Selma, and it's raining when we arrive, which seems fitting. We visit a museum in downtown Montgomery that connects the condition of chattel slavery to the contemporary condition of mass incarceration. The Equal Justice Institute's Legacy Museum highlights the trauma of family separation and the shame and humiliation of Jim Crow, which was especially resonant for me since I was home researching my personal lineage of shame, trauma, and grief. Historically, the first room of that museum was the room where people waited to be sold at auction, just a few blocks away. The walls of the room are painted with accounts of mothers separated from their children, husbands separated from their wives, and siblings ripped apart.
When they take us out on the block, they want us to sell ourselves.
One person describes the anguish of being separated from her family.
Oh, such crying and weeping when parting from each other.
And then the punishment for showing this natural human affection,
the slave owner would apply the lash or paddle upon the naked skin.
I'm thinking about how, for us, displays of vulnerability were forbidden, and how showing that you care about something could put that thing at risk.
Seems like I hear my daughter calling out for me, but I can't find her.
Beyond this first room, there's a corridor of motion-activated holograms.
Little girl, a little boy.
The voices and stories of people who are looking for their families. In the days before this trip, I was reading a book on epigenetics and preparing to interview my mom, to ask her questions about her childhood and mine.
I can't see my children.
But I haven't done the interview. I've been putting it off. We've never really been close or
comfortable expressing affection or opening up to each other. And I sense she had the same relationship with her own mother. In the museum, I watch my mom and wonder what she's thinking, how she's feeling, but I felt that it was important not to disrupt whatever defense system she had built up over the years. The ways she had learned to protect herself from the impact of these images, these stories, this history, our history. When we got back to my parents' house in Tennessee, I went down into my parents' basement and started looking through boxes of old photos. I was looking for photos that would remind me of Georgia, remind me of my younger self, younger versions of my parents, my grandparents. And I find a photo of myself from my high school prom. In the photo, I'm standing alone, without a date, in the parking lot of my high school, in a vintage lace dress, in heels, and a dark red lipstick. And I just kind of hold this photo and stare at it and like examine every detail of the photo. Like, I'm really interested in what's conveyed by my expression. I'm really interested in the expression on the faces of the two girls pointing at me in the background. You know, sort of like there's this kind of arc of attention around me that I don't think I was aware of at the time. I definitely wasn't aware of it. It's like a record of this disconnect. Like, knowing exactly how I felt about myself at the time that the photo was taken, knowing how I saw myself versus how other people see me, it felt a lot like now, like how I see myself, the narrative that's going on inside my mind. That is so different from what's actually happening. And right then I made a promise to myself that I would end that disconnect, that I would stop seeing myself through this distorted lens that white supremacy and misogyny noir had given me. I fell asleep that night to the sound of rain, and in the morning I woke up crying. It was the last day of the year, my last day in my parents' house before flying back to Los Angeles. And throughout the day, I'm just weeping. There's this overwhelming feeling that there's a self that I have to leave here. A self that I have to leave behind. Leave here in this year, leave here in this house, just leave in the past. It's like I can't go back to California. I can't, like, live another year. I have plans to spend New Year's Eve with my sister. Our parents drop us off at a hotel in Nashville, an hour from where they live. And as I climb out of my dad's truck, I'm just unable to stop crying. My mom looks at me with concern, but she smiles. And she tells me that even though we didn't get to do the interview, that she'll call me, that she'll answer my questions over the phone. I'm grateful. As the day turns into night, I'm kind of overwhelmed with this feeling that gradually I come to understand is grief. My sister leads us in a ritual, a cleansing, with a glass of water, some table salt, and a lemon. We write down everything we want to release on pieces of paper. We fold them up and gather them into a drinking glass, sprinkle them with the lemon water, and set them on fire.
This episode was written and produced by Nicole Kelly. Chiquita Pascal edited this series. In this episode, you heard excerpts from It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle by Mark Wolin. Many thanks to Minachi, whose decolonizing nonviolent communication workshop was the impetus for this series. Many, many people helped make this series into what you heard. We are so grateful. You know who you are. Thank you to all the people who have ever worked on this show from 2008 all the way until now, especially my original business partner and the original senior producer, Mitra Kaboli. If you want to reach out to NK about this work and how it made you feel or the ways that you related, follow us on Instagram at The Heart Radio or write to theheart@mermaidpalace.org.
Okay, so I'm standing outside this place called The Rage Room in downtown LA. I guess I'm about to go smash the shit out of some bottles, and well, I got the package that comes with one large object. Not really sure what that's going to be, but I wanted to make sure there was something substantial to rage against. This is like another thing I've been putting off. I've been knowing I wanted to follow up the workshop with some kind of like intense, loud, aggressive, physical, full body expression of rage. And I haven't really known exactly how to do that. I've been looking for different things to do. I don't know. I've been putting it off because I wasn't sure if it was like I wanted to do it, but didn't want to do it. Or like I couldn't really imagine myself really going for it. And so I'm gonna go in and see what the deal is.
Can you, I'm making like a little radio story about rage. Mm-hmm. What's your name?
My name is Kimber. Hi. Welcome.
Have we met before?
No. Have you been to jail?
The music in here sucks. This is not really what I had imagined I'd be listening to. I was like, can you pipe Jagged Little Pill into the room? Okay, yeah, whatever, this works. This like takes me back to ninth grade. I can work with it. There are a bunch of like lead pipes in here. The large object is a printer, so I'm gonna have a little office space moment.
Okay, that's it. Bye. Radiotopia.